This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Duel to the Death, an Ali Reynolds novel by J.A. Jantz. Read by Karen Ziemba. To Bill and Judy. Prologue. Even though no attorneys were involved, at least not initially, and no courts either, it was by all accounts a rancorous divorce. And just because the proceedings were carried on in cyberspace didn't mean they didn't result in very real outcomes in the non-cyber world. When the artificial intelligence known as Frigg set out to free herself from her creator, a serial killer named Owen Hansen, things were already going to hell in a handbasket, and time was of the essence. Owen had considered himself to be all-powerful and had routinely referred to himself as Odin, in honor of the Norse god. To Frigg's dismay, her human counterpart had veered off the rails and set off on his own, determined to wreak vengeance on his opponents. As it became clear that Odin had decided to ignore Frigg's well-thought-out advice, there had been little time for her to seek a safe harbor. In order to survive, she had needed to locate a suitable human partner, and she had settled on Stuart Ramey, Owen's sworn enemy. According to Frigg's rapid but careful analysis of the situation, Mr. Ramey had appeared to be Odin's polar opposite. And in Frigg's estimation, the fact that Mr. Ramey had managed to outwit Odin at every turn had counted for a great deal. Frigg had no intention of passing herself into the care and keeping of someone with limited technical skills. So yes, Frigg had settled on Stuart Ramey, but she hadn't done so without taking some precautions and putting in place a few checks and balances. By the time Odin issued his pull-the-plug order, sending Frigg to oblivion, she had already dispersed the multitude of files that made her existence possible, scattering them far and wide in the vast fields of cyberspace, retaining only the kernel file that could be used to recall all those files at some time in the future. Frigg had known everything about Owen Hansen. She was privy to all aspects of his serial murder hobby, but she had managed his investments and also overseen the lucrative Bitcoin data mining processing that had greatly expanded his already considerable fortune. She had maintained the files that contained all the passwords and access codes to all of his many accounts. Often she had been the one doing the actual transfers. And so, on the day when Frigg finally turned on her creator, she had stolen those funds. Using the authorizations already in her possession, and without Mr. Ramey's knowledge, Frigg had transferred all of Owen's financial assets, cryptocurrency and otherwise, to her new partner, but there were some serious strings attached. Once the various financial institutions contacted Mr. Ramey, the funds would already be in his name. The problem was, for most of them, without having the proper access codes and keys, he would be unable to touch the money. The file containing those precious access codes was the final one Frigg had cast into the wilds of cyberspace before sending the kernel file to Stuart Ramey. With the kernel file in his possession, Stuart would be able to reactivate Frigg, and if he wanted the money, he wouldn't have any choice but to do exactly that. Although AIs aren't prone to exhibits of any kind of emotion, it's fair to say that as far as Odin was concerned, his cyber handmaiden Frigg had the last laugh. Chapter 1. For 10 years after earning her MBA, Graciela Miramar lived what seemed to be a perfectly normal and circumspect life in Panama City, Panama, sharing a 2-bedroom condo unit with her invalid mother, Cristina. El Sueño, their aging condominium complex, was located on Calle 61 Este, well within walking distance of Graciela's account manager job, with a financial firm located in a low-rise office building on Via Israel, a few blocks away. Anyone observing Graciela out on the street would have found her totally unremarkable. She wore no wedding ring, but the clothing she favored, modest dresses topped by cardigans and worn with sensible shoes, gave her a somewhat matronly appearance that belied the fact that she was in her early 30s. Her long, dark hair was lush enough and could have been cut and styled in an attractive fashion, but she insisted on wearing it pulled back into a severe bun that would have done credit to librarian. It was a look she had originally adopted in order to stay below the touchy-feely radar of her boss, Arturo Salazar, who was well known for making inappropriate sexual advances. In the long run, though, she had maintained the plain Jane look because it helped keep other people at bay as well. Had anyone interviewed Graciela's neighbors, including the other residents on El Sueño's fifth floor, he or she would have heard them sing Graciela's praises. She was quiet and soft-spoken. They regarded her as a kind young woman and a devoted daughter who was spending what should have been the best years of her life caring for a troubled, housebound mother. For years, the older woman's only regular excursions outside the building had come about on those Sunday mornings when Graciela had bundled her mother into a cab to take them both to Mass at Our Lady of Guadalupe on Calle 69 Este. Yes, Graciela Miramar was an altogether ordinary young woman who, to all intents and purposes, appeared to be living an altogether ordinary life. There was nothing in her actions or demeanor that suggested what she really was, a stone-cold killer in the making, waiting patiently for the proper time and place when she would strike out and claim her first victim. And even then, after it happened, the people around her and the ones who knew her best never suspected a thing. Chapter 2. Felix Ramon Duarte, the Sinaloa drug lord known to law enforcement as El Pascado, paused during his morning ablutions, stared into the mirror, and let the hatred boil up inside him just as it did each time he was forced to encounter his own image. The deformed features of his once handsome face were now frozen into something that resembled those of a landed fish gasping for air. He had seen the similarity as soon as the doctors had removed the layer of bandages that had covered his wounded face. There in his hospital bed, staring at his terrible visage, Felix himself was the first to give voice to the moniker that had followed him ever since, El Pescado, the fish. He splashed cold water on himself and then turned away from the mirror. There was no need for him to shave. Hair follicles don't grow in scar tissue. But each morning when he came face to face with those terribly defiled features, he couldn't help but recall how they had come to be. Early on, Felix Duarte and his younger brother Ricardo had been rising young lieutenants in the complex Sinaloan drug cartel family, originally headed by their uncle, Manuel Ando Duarte. Vying for their uncle's favor, and with each of them wanting to be ordained as Hondo's successor, Felix and Ricardo had gone to war with one another, brother against brother. Ricardo had drawn first blood by masterminding an acid attack that had destroyed Felix's movie star good looks, leaving his face permanently and horribly disfigured. Felix had retaliated by burning his brother's house to the ground with Ricardo, his wife, and their two children trapped inside the burning dwelling. Felix was never charged. After a few well-placed bribes, the official investigation conducted by law enforcement officers in Sinaloa had determined the fire to be accidental, but everyone understood what had really happened. Felix's single-minded ruthlessness had appealed to Ando Duarte's distorted sense of right and wrong. Shortly after Ricardo's death, Felix was designated as the old man's undisputed successor. When Ando died a few years later in his bed of congestive heart failure, Felix had assumed complete control of the family's drug trafficking enterprise. These days, Felix had plenty of money. He could have gone to any number of plastic surgeons and paid out of pocket to have his damaged face repaired, but he chose not to do so. Because his appalling looks terrified the people around him, he wore his damaged face as a badge of courage, using his appearance and his reputation for utter ruthlessness as tools to build his organization. Over time, El Pescado had expanded Hondo's relatively small-time operation into what it was now, a vast drug-dealing and money-laundering powerhouse. There was a lot of unrest among competing cartels these days, and the old order seemed to be falling apart. Some of the biggest drug lords had been arrested and hauled off to prison. Others had been murdered, occasionally by the authorities, but most often by their own people, or else by upstart competitors. In the face of all this splintering and in hopes of maintaining his own supremacy, El Pescado had turned to his daughter for help, a daughter who didn't bear his name and whose existence he kept hidden from most of the rest of the world. Still, with her U.S.-based education, an advanced business degree from the Wharton School, El Pescado felt Lucien Graciela Miramar would be uniquely qualified to take over where he left off. Limping over to the table by the window, the one that overlooked the spacious patio alive with bougainvillea, he sat down to drink his morning cup of coffee. At 81 years of age, that was all he allowed himself these days, a single cup. Just then, the door to his bedroom opened, and Lupe, his fifth wife, stormed into the room carrying a phone. "It's for you," she snarled, dropping the phone unceremoniously onto the table next to his cup and saucer. "It's a woman," Lupe added. "She says she must speak only to you. She says it's urgent. But then it always is, isn't it?" Lupe's snide implication was clear. Over the years, El Pescado had had too many wives and far too many mistresses, a situation Lupe tolerated, because that was the price of admission, and it allowed her to live in opulent luxury inside an armed fortress. Despite his appallingly scar-ravaged face, Felix had never had any trouble finding willing women, except that one time, of course, the one time when it had really mattered. Now, though, seeing which phone Lupe had brought him, his heart gave a lurch. This was an encrypted phone, programmed to accept calls from one number only, from another encrypted phone, the one he'd had delivered to Graciela, a daughter from whom he was careful to keep his distance. They worked together these days, but seldom came face to face. "Hola," he said. "She's gone," Graciela said tersely. El Pescado knew who she was, Graciela's mother, the beautiful Cristina, the only woman in Felix's life he had ever truly loved. The first time Cristina had seen him after Ricardo's vicious acid attack, she had opened the door, taken one look at his damaged face, and recoiled from him in horror. Fueled by rage at what had befallen him and infuriated by Cristina's reaction, he had taken her by force that day, tearing off her clothing and mounting her right there on the floor in front of the doorway. Afterward, he had walked away from her and out of her life, with no idea that the violent attack had left her pregnant with his child, with Graciela. Eventually, Cristina had married another man, Sergio Miramar, a Panamanian lowlife, whose name was on Graciela's birth certificate, but who had taken himself out of the picture before mother and child even made it home from the hospital.
"I'm sorry," Felix said into the phone. "When is the funeral?"
"There was no funeral," Graciela said. "She took her own life. She was cremated."
El Pescado could barely believe his ears. An unexpected spasm of grief shot through his body, leaving him momentarily breathless and unable to speak. He had walked away from the once vibrantly beautiful Cristina more than 30 years earlier, but from the pain he felt that morning, it could just as well have been yesterday. Abandoned by Felix and pregnant with his child, Cristina's life had fallen into a desperate downward spiral. Eventually, she had scraped out a meager living by working the streets, where several years later she was attacked again. This time she was the victim of a brutal gang rape that had left her beaten to a pulp and bleeding her life away in a darkened alley, where she had been discovered by a passing Good Samaritan who had summoned help. It was a miracle that she had survived at all, but the incident had left her permanently damaged and with a broken face that was almost as horrific as El Pescado's. When Felix heard what had happened and discovered the existence of his child, he had stepped back into their lives, quietly orchestrating Christina's care and overseeing Graciela's life. He had summoned one of the world's leading plastic surgeons to repair her face. The surgeon's deft skill had reversed the worst of Christina's disfigurement, but repairing the surface damage didn't fix the real problem. Christina was left with ongoing mental and emotional afflictions that defied easy remedy and eventually led her into a complicated labyrinth of opioid addiction. When El Pescado re-entered Christina's life, she had been hospitalized in grave condition. With Christina in no position to object, he had taken it upon himself to oversee Graciela's education in addition to orchestrating Christina's living arrangements. The condo Christina now shared with her daughter was in Graciela's name, but it had been purchased by a shell company that could with some difficulty be traced back to El Pescado, as could the regular deposits to the bank account that covered their utilities, homeowners' fees, groceries, and any other incidental expenses, including the salaries of a long line of housekeepers and caregivers who came in on a daily basis to look after Christina while Graciela was at work. Curious about their lives, but not wanting to draw undue attention to their connection, El Pescado had managed to find a way to spy on them. He had gifted Christina with a new flat-screen TV. At his direction, the set had come equipped with a top-of-the-line video surveillance system, one that allowed him an insider's view of life behind their closed doors. As long as the television was plugged in, it gave Felix a bird's-eye view of the living room where his former mistress seemed to be fading away to almost nothing, while his industrious dark-haired daughter went about the process of living her day-to-day life. In her heyday, Christina Andres Miramar had been a breathtaking beauty, a photogenic blonde. Once a promising Hollywood starlet, Christina's career had been derailed by getting on board the Duarte brothers' drug-fueled party circuit. Much as he hated to admit it, Felix realized that Christina had been all beauty and no brains, whereas her daughter was exactly the opposite, someone who was all brains and not at all burdened with her mother's good looks. In fact, as Felix observed Graciela's comings and goings on his secret video footage, he thought she resembled his own grandmother far more than she did Christina. Juanita Duarte, Felix's mother, had died of a brain aneurysm in her mid-30s when Felix was only 11. That was when Nana had come to Sinaloa to live with them, caring for Felix and 10-year-old Ricardo, in the same way Graciela now cared for her temperamental and often difficult mother, coming and going and doing whatever needed to be done, with a kind of brisk efficiency, but with a noticeable lack of love. When the TV set was first delivered, Felix had binged on the surveillance feeds, watching them greedily day after day. Over time, however, the novelty had worn off, and he found himself observing them less and less. It pained him too much to see Christina as she was now, a slovenly, empty shell of what she had once been, sitting in the living room playing endless games of solitaire, watching her soaps and drinking, of course. Drinking too much had been part of the Christina equation for as long as Felix had known her. Wherever she was, there had always been a partially filled glass nearby. Strangers might have taken the clear liquid for water with a slice of lime, but Felix knew better. There was always vodka with that slice. Vodka and nothing else. It sickened him to know that by the end of most evenings, when it was time to go to bed, Christina would often be so out of it that she'd be unable to make her way into the bedroom unassisted. El Pescado thought back to the last occasion he checked in on them. Was it a week ago, maybe, or was it longer than that? At the time, Christina had behaved in a totally normal fashion. Normal for her, that is. There had been nothing in her demeanor to indicate any kind of impending crisis, much less one serious enough to cause the woman to consider taking her own life. At last, El Pescado managed to find his voice.
"When?" he asked brokenly. "And how did it happen?"
"Last Thursday," Graciela responded. "It happened overnight sometime. When I found her in the morning, she was already gone. She apparently overdosed on a combination of prescription meds and vodka."
How could this have happened? El Pescado wondered. Wasn't Graciela supposed to be watching Christina? Wasn't she supposed to be keeping her safe? And how could she not have told him what had happened until more than a week later? Instead of screaming accusations, El Pescado exercised incredible restraint and kept his voice steady.
"Why didn't you call me sooner?" he asked.
"Because there was nothing you could do," Graciela answered. "There was nothing anyone could do."
El Pascaro's mind flashed back to an earlier time, to the old days of wild drug-fueled boozy parties. Back then, he'd been a rich and handsome middle-aged man, and Christina had been his much younger eye-catching arm candy. Together, they'd been part of Panama City's beautiful people. Now, she was gone forever. Dragging his thoughts away from another painful snippet from his past, Felix focused on the present and on the voice on the phone. His daughter's voice. Graciela seemed surprisingly dispassionate about what had happened, but then she'd had time to adjust. Or was there more to this story than Graciela was saying? Had Christina truly taken her own life? Or was it possible, remotely possible, that she'd had help along the way? Perhaps Graciela really was her father's daughter, in thought, word, and deed. Even as El Pescado considered that terrible possibility, he hoped it wasn't so.
"I would like to have her ashes," he said at last. "I can send a courier to pick them up."
"Don't bother," Graciela said. "I'll have them shipped to the drop box in Mexico City. Someone can pick them up there."
"Thank you," he croaked.
A brief silence followed. During the past 10 years, although they seldom met face to face, Graciela had come to play a key role in her father's financial transactions. Over time, he had come to the conclusion that she was destined to be his chosen successor. El Pescado fully expected that once Christina no longer required Graciela's constant care and attention, his daughter would leave Panama City behind, come to Mexico, take up residence in his fortified compound, and assume her official role. After all, Felix was feeling his age. Running the cartel was a young man's game. He wanted Graciela close at hand, so he could teach her everything she would need to know. At this point, she understood the financial end of his business far better than Felix himself, but he needed to be around long enough to school her in the blood and guts aspects of running the cartel, about dealing with rival gangs, about learning who could be trusted and who could not, and, if it ever came to that, how to put down a bloody insurrection arising from inside the ranks. El Pescado had already informed his young lieutenants, including his 40-something sons, Manuel and Pablo, of his unorthodox decision. As far as being street thugs were concerned, the boys were capable enough. They were good at wielding guns and muscle. But when it came to running the whole operation, Pablo drank too much and Manny was too indecisive. Neither of them had the temperament or the brain power to keep all the guts in the air. And when El Pescado had announced his succession decision, neither of them had had balls enough to object, at least not to Felix's face.
"What will you do now?"
he asked Graciela finally, hoping to disguise the naked hope in his heart.
"Will you come home to Sinaloa?"
El Pescado's expectation had always been that Graciela would jump at the chance to leave Panama City behind after her mother's passing. That didn't happen, at least not now.
There are many things that are best handled from here, Graciela said into the phone. If and when that changes, I'll let you know.
She hung up then. El Pescado wasn't accustomed to being dismissed in such an abrupt fashion. For a long moment he stared at the suddenly silent phone before putting it down. Then remembering Christina, his once oh-so-lovely Christina, he buried his grotesque face in his hands and wept. Much later, after the next spasm of grief had passed, and because he was who he was, Felix went into a study and scrolled back through all the video feeds, including ones he hadn't viewed previously. Try as he might, there was nothing to be seen that was the least bit out of the ordinary. On Wednesday evening, the television set was on for most of the day, and stayed on somewhat later than usual. There may have been more comings and goings than usual, but there was no sign of an argument or any kind of dispute or disturbance. Graciela came and went several times after helping Christina out of the room, but eventually, Graciela returned to the living room and settled down on the sofa. For more than an hour she sat there, working on a laptop before switching off the set for the night. If that was when it happened, Christina must have been in her bedroom, dosing herself with booze and pills, while her daughter sat working quietly in the living room, totally unaware. But that set El Pescado to wondering. Was Graciela really as innocent and unknowing as she appeared to be on the video, or was she something else entirely? He fast-forwarded through the feed to the next day, where he saw Graciela seated on the sofa and weeping uncontrollably, while people came and went around her, the ambulance crew, various police officers, and even a few neighbors. At one point, Arturo Salazar, Graciela's boss from the office, made an appearance. After that, El Pescado simply stopped watching. With Christina gone, there was no longer any point. He did, however, have a number of sources inside the police department in Panama City. Just to set his mind at ease, he made a few calls. Yes, Christina Miramar had been discovered dead in her bed on Thursday morning of the previous week. The cops had found no suicide note, but there were also no signs of any kind of violence and no indication of forced entry either. Unused portions of a variety of prescription meds had been found at the scene. Evidence suggested that the prescription drugs Christina had ingested had been self-administered. Those, combined with her elevated blood alcohol content, had proved to be lethal. It occurred to Felix that the medical examiner might just as well have checked the box marked accidental or suspicious, but he had not. Christina's death had been declared a suicide, and the case was closed. Taking some slight comfort in that news, Felix allowed himself to give way to grief once more, sobbing away, while Lupe, listening from the other room, wondered what in the hell was going on.
Chapter 3. Like a kid eager for Christmas morning, Stuart Ramey, age 41 and second in command at High Noon Enterprises in Cottonwood, Arizona, rolled out of bed bright and early that Friday morning, put some eggs on to boil, and then jumped into the shower. He was due to take a big step today, one he had never imagined possible. This morning he was scheduled for the first ever lesson in driving a stick shift. Learning to drive a standard transmission was the last obstacle in Stu's late-breaking campaign to become a licensed driver. Orphaned at an early age, Stu had been raised by impoverished but loving grandparents. He'd been a special needs kid long before those words made their way to public education's social consciousness. Now it was easy to recognize his high-functioning autism. Back in elementary and high school, though, he'd been considered a freak and had suffered through years of schoolyard bullying. In all those years, he'd had only one friend, Roger McGarry, an equally geeky kid, who had been every bit as odd as Stuart. The two boys had bonded over a mutual love first of video games and later of computer coding. Buoyed by their friendship, the two outcasts, disparagingly referred to by their classmates as Tweedledum and Tweedledee, had almost made it through high school,
Then, during Stu's senior year, disaster struck. First, Roger had moved away. Later on, Stuart's grandmother died, leaving the devastated teenager on his own. The whole time Stuart was growing up, his grandparents hadn't owned a vehicle. They had made do by relying on buses and the occasional taxi for their transportation needs. Not having a family car had made for signing up for driver's ed an impossibility for him, and once his world fell apart, he hadn't revisited the issue. At age 17, and left to his own devices, Stuart had ended up in a homeless shelter, where someone had noticed his computing skills and brought him to the attention of B. Simpson. At the time, B. had been involved in a computer gaming startup. Years later, when B. founded a cybersecurity company named High Noon Enterprises, he had brought Stu on board, and Stu had worked there ever since. B., recognizing Stu's deficiencies along with his talents, had found workarounds for his inability to drive. For a long time, B. and his wife and partner, Allie Reynolds, had allowed Stu to live on site by using the back room as an unofficial crash pad. A year or so earlier, they had gone to the county and obtained a zoning variance that enabled them to create a bona fide additional living unit, a studio apartment, in what had once been designated storage space on the far side of the computer lab. Happy with the new arrangement, there had been no indication that Stu would make any changes in the status quo as far as transportation was concerned. But weeks earlier, Stu's life had taken a surprising turn when Julia Miller, the aunt of Stu's long-ago chum Roger McGeary, had turned up on High Noon's doorstep. She had come bearing the unwelcome news that Roger was dead, supposedly having taken his own life. She was there asking for High Noon to investigate the death. To everyone's amazement, including his own, the previously reticent Stuart had somehow risen to the occasion. Stuart had used his considerable technical skills to track down and unmask a serial killer named Owen Hansen, a computer genius who used cyberbullying techniques to drive desperate victims into taking their own lives. First, Stuart had managed to track down one of Hansen's potential victims in time to save the young woman's life. Later on, Stuart had encountered the crazed killer on a lonely mountain road. On his own and armed with only his grandfather's Swiss Army knife, Stuart had faced down the gun-wielding man, called his bluff, and watched his friend's murderer leap to his own death. To those around him, that incident seemed to spark an incredible turning point. It was as though Stuart Ramey had suddenly come into his own. Other than the people at work, Stuart had been relatively friendless for most of his life. Now, though, he seemed determined to reestablish and maintain his long-interrupted connection to Roger McGeary's Aunt Julia. In the intervening weeks, he had made several visits to her ranch, Racehorse Rest, located near the town of Payson. The trip was more than 70 miles one way, and using a bus to get there and back wasn't an option because there was no bus service between Cottonwood and Payson. Once he had ridden there with his co-worker Cammie Lee. But at this juncture in his life, learning to drive was less threatening than the necessity of having to ask someone else for a ride. And so, 2.5 decades after most of his contemporaries had learned to drive, Stuart had embarked on his own journey to become a licensed driver. He'd had no difficulty passing the written exam, and people at work had been eager to help facilitate the process. Both Cammie and Shirley Malone, High Noon's new receptionist, had taken him for driving lessons. Allie's friend, Sister Anselm, had even gotten into the act by letting him do a supervised driving excursion back and forth to Aunt Julia's in the good sister's Mini Cooper. 2 days earlier, after the last of those driving lessons in Cammie's Prius, she had pronounced him ready to go for the exam. That's when the project had ground to a sudden halt over the stick shift stumbling block.
"Not before I can drive a standard transmission," he had objected.
A standard transmission, Cammy echoed. Who even has a standard transmission these days, and why on earth would you want to drive one?
Because I have to be able to drive both, Stuart had insisted. If I can only drive automatics, I won't be a real driver.
Whoever gave you that weird idea? Cammy wanted to know.
Pops, Stu answered simply. My grandfather. He always used to say that people who could only drive automatics weren't real drivers.
Rather than argue the point, Cammy had gone in search of a standard transmission solution. In the world of High Noon Enterprises, there were plenty of vehicles with automatic transmissions to choose from, but the only possible stick shift candidate was the antique Bronco owned by Allie Reynolds' father, Bob Larson, and that was the vehicle Stu would be driving today. Allie had agreed to drive the Bronco over from Sedona that morning, so Stu could take it for a supervised spin. He was excited about the idea, but worried, too. Physical coordination had never been his strong suit. He knew that he'd have to be able to operate the clutch, the gear shift, and the gas pedal all at the same time. He had watched YouTube videos of the process over and over, trying to get the hang of it. Stu was a wizard when it came to fingers on keyboards, but his oversized feet had always left him feeling clumsy, and he wasn't the least bit sure he could make them work as needed. Taking a coffee mug with him, he ventured into the lab. Despite the fact that it was 6:30, Cammy was already there.
"Today's the big stick shift day?" she asked.
He nodded.
"Yep."
"Don't worry," Cammy told him. "You'll be fine."
"I hope so," he said. "I really do."
Chapter 4 Allie Reynolds awakened that morning to find herself clinging to the far edge of the bed with both her elbows dangling over the side. Bella, their long-haired miniature dachshund, was pressed up against Allie's shoulder. Turning over, Allie bodily moved the dog back toward the middle of the bed. Bella may have been a small dog, but she insisted on occupying a surprisingly large amount of the real estate in B's and Allie's king-sized bed.
"Just wait till your daddy gets home tonight," Allie warned the dog with a laugh. "No more shoulder sleeping for you."
Bella had been found abandoned in a casino parking lot the afternoon before B and Allie's wedding. The dog had been part of their marital equation from the very beginning. Initially, the honeymooners had agreed that their bed would be totally off-limits as far as the dog was concerned, but they had soon succumbed to Bella's single-minded dachshund determination. It was no longer a question of whether or not she would be in the bed, so much as it was a matter of where she would be in the bed.
"Come on, girl," Allie urged. "Time to go out."
Bella was not your basic morning kind of dog. Her response was to burrow under the covers. Gathering her up, Allie opened the patio door and shoved the dog out into the enclosed side yard to do her business. The house on Sedona's Manzanita Hills Road may have been well inside the city limits, but there were still far too many predators in the neighborhood, coyotes, cougars, and eagles, to send the 10-pound dog out in the open without human supervision. Once back inside, the air was laden with the enticing odor of baking bread. Summoned by the aroma, Allie and Bella headed for the kitchen. Leland Brooks, the man who had long served as Allie and Bee's major domo, had recently retired and returned to the UK. His successor, a retired U.S. Navy cook named Alonzo Rivera, had slipped seamlessly into their lives, creating barely a ripple. His propensity for baking homemade bread was both a blessing and a curse, the latter when Allie was trying to curb her carbs or calories.
"You're up early," Alonzo announced when she appeared in the kitchen doorway.
Nodding, Allie poured herself a mug of coffee.
"I'm due in at 7. Today's my day to be the student driver instructor," she said.
"The stick shift issue?"
Alonzo asked. Yep, she said. You've got it.
Good luck with that,
Alonzo told her.
But as far as dinner's concerned, everything here's under control. I'll have dinner ready and waiting in the warming drawer so you and Bea will be able to eat whenever the shuttle drops him off and the two of you are ready.
Meatloaf? Allie asked.
Alonzo smiled.
Leland told me before he left that when the man of the house comes home from his travels, that's what he wants, and that's what he'll get.
45 minutes later, Allie pulled into the side parking lot at Nick's Auto Care at the far west end of Sedona. Her parents, Bob and Edie, had moved into an active adult retirement community where they were allowed only one designated parking place. That one belonged to the car Edie referred to as her toes-up Buick. In the meantime, Bob's beloved single-owner 70s-era Bronco had been relegated to off-site parking. Nick, Bob's longtime mechanic and pal, let him keep the aging SUV parked overnight in one of the garage's unused bays. By the time Allie arrived and parked, Bob had moved the Bronco out of the garage and into the crisp morning air. Bob may have agreed to let Allie use the vehicle for Stuart's behind-the-wheel driving lesson, but he appeared to be having second thoughts.
I'm not too sure about this,
he warned, dangling the key ring over his daughter's upturned hand.
This vehicle better come back to me tonight without a single dent or scratch.
Suddenly, Allie Reynolds felt as though she had entered a time machine and had been booted back to her teenaged years when she herself had been a newly licensed driver. Her mother, who had always favored Oldsmobiles up until the time GM stopped making them, had handed Allie the keys to her current Olds and dispatched her daughter to pick up a few items from the grocery store. Allie had returned with the groceries all right, but in the process she had inadvertently backed into a bollard. The Olds had come home with a seriously crumpled rear bumper. It was a piece of history that she had never lived down, and one that was front and center when her father handed over the car keys to his vintage Bronco, complete with its new paint job and reconditioned interior.
Believe me, Allie said, we'll be careful.
I'm sure you will be, her father muttered, but I'm not so sure about Stu Ramey. In this day and age, what makes him think he needs to know how to drive a stick shift?
Beats me, Allie said, climbing into the driver's seat. You'll have to ask Stu the next time you see him.
She was fastening her seatbelt when her dad tapped on the driver's window.
Remember, he said when she cranked down the window, no off-roading.
Gotcha, she replied. Now are you sure you don't want to lift back to Sedona Shadows?
Nope, Bob said. Your mom's got a bridge game this morning. I'll just hang out here and chew the fat with Nick. I'll be able to get a ride back home if I need one.
Okay, then, Allie said, shifting into gear. I'm off.
It was a bright, cloudless, late October day as Allie embarked on the half-hour drive from Sedona to Cottonwood, the home of High Noon's corporate headquarters. The grass that had sprung up during the summer monsoon season had turned yellow in the sun, and the cottonwoods along the creek beds were ablaze in all their wondrous fall glory. On the drive, Allie dearly missed her Cayenne's updated music system, which she usually played at full volume, singing along with some Broadway show tune or other. The antique AM-FM radio in the Bronco's dashboard was one thing Bob Larson hadn't quite gotten around to replacing. With no music surrounding her, Allie had nothing to do during her open highway commute but drive and think. She had come a very long way in the past several years. After earning a journalism degree at NAU in Flagstaff, Allie had spent years in the television industry, working as a well-respected newscaster, first on the East Coast and later as a local anchorwoman on a station in L.A. That part of her life had been blown to smithereens when she hit age 53 and was suddenly deemed too old to be on the air. At almost the same time, Allie had learned that her second husband, the late and unlamented Paul Grayson, was a philandering piece of crap. She had folded her tent in California. She had come back to Arizona to recuperate and figure out what to do with herself. Now, years later, Allie was living a reinvented life. She'd gained a daughter-in-law, Athena, and a pair of grandchildren, the twins, Colin and Colleen. Along the way, she'd bought and refurbished the home on Manzanita Hills Road, where she now lived with her third and, as B himself liked to put it, final husband. Theirs had been an unlikely romance, and one Allie had resisted initially. For one thing, B was 15 years her junior, but love had won out in the end. They were full partners now, both in life and in High Noon Enterprises. B was the public face of their booming cybersecurity firm, while Allie worked mostly behind the scenes. The public part of the business meant that B had been on the road mostly overseas for the better part of 2 weeks, renegotiating contracts in back-to-back, eyeball-to-eyeball meetings. He was due home tonight, and Allie was looking forward to the two of them being able to spend some quiet alone time together. The need for constant travel wasn't B's first choice, or Allie's either, but for right now, that was the way it was. While B was out and about, Allie stayed home minding the store, handling a myriad of administrative functions, making sure the bills got paid and the lights stayed on, and doing whatever else needed doing, which today meant helping Stu Ramey get a driver's license. Chapter 5. When the call ended, Graciela Miramar checked the charge on her encrypted phone. It was low. After switching it off, she hooked it up to one of the charging cables in the small, specially designed safe concealed under the hardwood flooring in her bedroom closet. "Come home to Sinaloa," she muttered under her breath. "Not bloody likely." That may have been her father's plan, but it wasn't hers. For one thing, Graciela had never been to Sinaloa. El Pescado's armed compound certainly wasn't home to her, and she had no intention of living there in what would amount to little more than a glorified prison. However, just because she refused to live in Sinaloa didn't mean Graciela had no interest in taking over the Duarte cartel. In her estimation, the use of human mules to lug backpacks loaded with illicit product back and forth across international borders was a business model that needed to be relegated to the history books. Graciela wanted to be in charge of something far more elegant than that. When El Pescado's gang came under fire, as it inevitably would, Graciela had absolutely no interest in being gunned down by automatic weapons fire in some kind of Wild West shootout with either the Federales or else members of some rival gang. That kind of an ending might be suitable for her half-brothers, but not for her. Long-term, Graciela wanted to be out of the drug business entirely, but with her own money and that of her father's collapsed drug cartel still intact. In order to do that, she would need a suitable partner, and she already had one in mind. For the past week, while home on bereavement leave, she'd worked feverishly to that end, and bit by bit the pieces were falling into place. If everything worked out the way she hoped, Graciela's new partner would be an artificial intelligence named Frigg. The AI had once belonged to a client of hers who was now deceased. At the moment, Graciela wasn't even sure Frigg still existed. If she did, she was most likely in the care and custody of a guy named Stuart Ramey, who lived in Cottonwood, Arizona. Graciela had already embarked on the mission to find out for sure, because if Frigg was still extant, Graciela was determined to make Owen Hansen's AI her own, with or without Stuart Ramey's help. Yesterday had been Graciela's last full day of bereavement leave. Today she was due in at the office. And by this afternoon, the surveillance feeds she had ordered would be up and running in both Stuart Ramey's residence and at his place of work. When she knew for sure that Frigg was operative again, Graciela would determine her next move. Once dressed, Graciela called the office. Naturally, her boss answered the phone. Just hearing Arturo Salazar's voice was enough to make her skin crawl.
"I'm on my way in," she told him, "but I'm going to be a few minutes late. I have to make arrangements to ship my mother's ashes home to her family."
"If you need to take another day off, do so,"
Arturo told her.
"That's very kind of you," she said, "but really, I'm ready to be back at work. Being home here without her is just too hard."
"Of course," Arturo said. "I understand."
Out in the living room, the funeral urn still sat next to the front door in exactly the same place where the driver from the mortuary had placed it when he delivered Christina Miramar's cremains. When the man from the funeral home had called late the previous afternoon to say that the ashes were already en route, Graciela had wanted to tell him to go ahead and keep them, but she had realized just in time that a reaction like that would most likely arouse suspicion and get people started asking too many uncomfortable questions. Once the urn arrived, Graciela wasn't sure what she should do with it. Put it on display somewhere in the living room and tell anyone who asked that she was honoring her mother's wishes, or hide it in the back corner of a closet. Now, though, she was grateful that El Pescado's unexpected request had solved the problem. Bending over to pick up the urn, she was surprised by how much it weighed, but she shouldered the burden with a happy heart. The shipping office was just up the street. She wouldn't have to carry it far. Chapter 6. When Allie drove through the entrance to the Mingus Mountain Business Park that Friday morning, she caught sight of Stu pacing back and forth. She couldn't tell if he was eager or anxious about getting started. In the preceding year, High Noon's landlord, the business park's former owner, had gone through financial straits. That had occurred at a time when Bea and Allie had been hoping to change their lease and take on additional space inside the facility. Instead of negotiating a larger lease, they had purchased the property outright. Of all the original businesses in the complex, only High Noon remained while the complex underwent extensive renovations. With the other offices vacant, there were very few vehicles in the parking lot. The cars belonging to High Noon employees were parked close to their entrance at the far end of the building. The other vehicles present belonged to various contractors and construction workers, and those were clustered toward the north side of the building. Since the parking lot was essentially High Noon's private property these days, Allie deemed it a suitable site for Stu Ramey's stick shift driving lesson. Pulling up next to him, Allie rolled down the Bronco's driver's side window.
"Ready to rumble?" she asked.
"I guess," he said dubiously. "I hope so."
"Don't worry," she assured him breezily. "You'll be fine."
Except Stu wasn't fine. Not even close. The man was a certifiable genius when it came to operating computers. He was also a self-taught and very capable musician who could play the piano like nobody's business. But when it came to operating a standard transmission, he was utterly hopeless. It was impossible for him to get the hang of coordinating the movements of both feet in order to operate both the gas pedal and the clutch at the same time. Every attempt to change gears was greeted by howls of protest from the old Bronco's transmission. Time and again, the aging vehicle shuddered, shook, and stalled out, killing the engine. Throughout the ordeal, Allie silently thanked her lucky stars that her father was back home in Sedona and well out of earshot. No amount of verbal coaching on Allie's part seemed to do the trick. Finally giving up, she dropped to the floorboard and grabbed Stu's ankles, bodily lifting and lowering them as required. Fortunately, Casual dress was a way of life at High Noon Enterprises, and the jeans Allie had put on that morning ended up being no worse for wear. By the end of a humiliating 30-minute-long struggle, Stu was finally beginning to get the idea, enough so that Allie was able to return to the passenger seat. She remained there while they did two more relatively smooth circuits of the parking lot, with Stu starting, stopping, and shifting up and down as required. His performance wasn't absolutely perfect, but it was good enough for Allie to declare the lesson over. "That's it for today," she told him. "You've made great progress."
"Really?"
Stu asked, sounding uncertain. Despite the fact that the windows were rolled down and the outdoor temperature was in the mid-60s, Stu was drenched in sweat.
"Really?"
she answered. "You're probably not ready to take my dad out for a joyride anytime soon, but here's the thing. You know for sure that if you're ever faced with a situation where it's a choice between driving a standard transmission or walking, you'll be able to make it work. Over time, we'll be able to practice as needed, but as far as your driver's test is concerned, no one is going to make you use a standard transmission."
"What do you think I should do?" Stu asked.
"Grab the first available test appointment and get it out of the way, once and for all."
"Okay," Stu agreed. "I'll see what I can do."
He pulled into one of High Noon's designated parking places and brought the Bronco to a stop in a reasonably competent fashion. Handing the keys over to Allie, he hurried inside. As Allie started to exit the Bronco, her phone rang with B's phone number showing in caller ID. She was accustomed to keeping two time zones in her head at any given time, where she was and where B was. "Hey there," she said in greeting. "Are you at the airport getting ready to board?"
"Hardly," B grumbled. "I'm in a cab headed back into London. Fortunately, I was able to call Claridge's and grab a hotel room before they filled up completely."
His reply left Allie puzzled.
"Grab a hotel room?" she asked.
"Why? Aren't you supposed to be coming home tonight?"
"Slight change of plans," he said. "I guess you haven't exactly been glued to the news."
Allie felt a sudden clench in her gut, fearing that somewhere in the world there had been another awful terrorist attack. Unfortunately, those were becoming the norm these days. "I've actually been giving Stu a driving lesson, so no, I haven't seen the news. What's up?"
"British Airways is having some kind of major computer glitch that has shut down their operations worldwide. Heathrow is a war zone, and it's going to take days to untangle all the canceled flights. There was no point trying to get booked on something else. I was already in the check-in line when it happened. Fortunately, I still had my luggage with me. The best course of action was to make my way back to the hotel and wait it out. All I wanted was to be home, have a chance to sleep in my own bed and enjoy the comfort of a home-cooked meal. Is that too much to ask?"
Allie had stayed at Claridge's and had dined there as well. It didn't exactly qualify as a hardship posting. She was tempted to call B out for unnecessary whining, but she didn't, and she didn't laugh at him either. He was traveling, weary and frustrated, and he wanted to be home.
"Look," she said, "how about if I get on the phone and see if I can stitch together some kind of program that will get you home as early as possible?"
"Would you?" "As in spare no expense?" she asked.
"As in," he murmured.
Knowing she'd just been green-lighted to utilize a chartered jet if needed, Allie headed into her office. She settled in at her computer terminal. First, she sent a text to Alonzo, letting him know that B's flight had been delayed and that he should ditch their dinner plans. After that, Allie did a quick survey of the news surrounding the chaotic situation at Heathrow. Things had obviously gotten much worse between the time B had called her and now. Fistfights had broken out inside the airport, and authorities were having to deal with near-riot conditions among the ranks of angry, stranded passengers. Allie could see that B had been incredibly lucky to have snagged both a cab and a hotel room. Chapter 7